Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
This episode is brought to you by Experian. Are you paying for subscriptions you don't use, but can't find the time or energy to cancel them? Experian could cancel unwanted subscriptions for you, saving you an average of $270 per year and plenty of time. Download the Experian app. Results will vary. Not all subscriptions are eligible. Savings are not guaranteed. Paid membership with connected payment account required.
Hello, and welcome to another Saturday episode. I've actually done all these, like set them to come out in advance. So I'm speaking to you from the past. That must sound annoying. I hate when people do those, like do silly voices and things on adverts and things, if you're driving and it's on the radio. So that'll be the last one today, at least from me. This is, as I often do on Saturdays, different kinds of things, interviews I do where I'm being interviewed by different people, or just my thoughts for the day, or different kinds of weird live streamy things that are not sort of the big Monday and Thursday podcast, but Saturday, a bit different. And today, I am being interviewed by Will Kingston, who is part of The Spectator Australia. He's got this podcast called Fire at Will. Obviously, the pun on his name being Will and Fire at Will, this sort of everything's, you know, go with the questions. And he has with me what he calls a heretical conversation with Andrew Gold. That's my name, of course. Heresy is defined as opinion profoundly at odds with what is generally accepted. It has rarely, Will writes, been more dangerous to be a heretic, which is why it's rarely been more important to champion them. There is no bigger heretic than Andrew Gold. And then he talks about me, which is lovely and wonderful and flattering. But Will is very much in the same mold as me. And I follow him on Twitter. He's really good. So look, if you like this episode, go and check out Fire at Will, because it's loads of similar episodes. He's had some great guests on, from Eric Kaufman to, well, I'm just scrolling down now. I've seen some big ones. Big people on. Let's have a look. Douglas Bloody Murray. Well, that's not bad. Catherine Brodsky, Matt Goodwin, lots of people who are on my podcast as well. So really similar kind of thing. If you like this and you want more stuff to listen to, give Will's podcast a go. That's Fire at Will. Do get hold of my book, The Psychology of Secrets. You can get it in all the sort of normal places. Leave a review for that. I've gone a bit Australian there. Leave a review for that. No, terrible. Sorry. And enjoy this episode. I'll be back at the end.
Heresy is defined as opinion profoundly at odds with what is generally accepted. It was once used to describe beliefs that were at odds with the church. And herein lies a paradox. Western society has never been less religious, particularly in countries like the UK, Australia, and Canada. And yet, heretical opinions have never been more dangerous to hold. Well, at least since the days of being burnt at the stake. It's not the church that heretics need to be worried about. It's the establishment. More or less, all of our societal institutions have been captured by progressive illiberal dogma. To question this orthodoxy can lead to a very 21st century equivalent of what the Witches of Salem endured: social media shaming, debanking, dismissal from your job, and general ostracization. That's precisely why heresy must be defended. And there is no greater defender of it than my guest today, Andrew Gold. Andrew is a journalist, author, and TV presenter who produces documentaries on bizarre and controversial subcultures. He has battled an abusive exorcist, dueled with the crazy baby lady, hunted UFOs, and spoken to a teen school captain who also happened to be a pedophile. His podcast is appropriately titled Heretics. Andrew, welcome to Fire at Will.
Well, thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you on. What is a crazy baby lady?
That's actually a documentary that didn't end up making it. I mean, I at first I wasn't able to sort of make documentaries for the BBC. They didn't really want me. And that, you know, I can get into the whole diversity issue around that, but also I wasn't anybody. And as anyone who knows, anyone who's tried to break into that industry, it's not easy. So at the beginning, I took these ideas to the BBC. I had done some smaller things before, of course, for different channels and things. And they were like, look, you know, you're not really big enough. We don't know who you are. Your ideas sound good, but whatever. So I made like this Exorcist film that did all right. So anyway, that did well. We ended up getting out to the BBC. So I thought, okay, is this a sustainable model or not? That I'll just go and make a documentary with a friend of mine who will hold the camera, will borrow stuff and work on a shoestring budget and make a crazy Louis Theroux kind of documentary where I go into a weird, crazy world. And so right after the Exorcism film, I had been living in Argentina and they were in the middle of this whole abortion debate. And they've got this almost Trump-esque, or if you've seen the Westboro Baptist Church stuff that Louis Theroux did, very much like a Westboro person, pro-lifer, called Mariana Rodriguez Varela. And she was just larger than life. She's a crazy character who goes to interrupt people trying to terminate their pregnancies by throwing plastic, sort of plastic and rubbery fetuses at them. They're not real, of course. And she's screaming at them. And she became known in Argentina as the crazy baby lady. So I was just trying for months and months to get access to her and told her I would be neutral and all of these things. And I ended up going around with her, went on the school run. I mean, the idea, the beautiful thing in the old Louis Theroux documentaries is even though he's mocking a lot of the right wing people in those documentaries, he was finding humanity in them at the same time. Not all of them. Some of the characters are beyond redemption, but some of them, you almost love them while you hate their views. And I find that really interesting. And I definitely started to fall in love in a documentary way with Mariana and her personality and her children and how she took us on the school runs and made us lunch and all those kinds of things. She was wonderful. And then would go around screaming at people trying to terminate their pregnancies. So that's who Mariana is, the crazy baby lady. By the end, I asked her questions that were a little bit too pressing, ones that I probably wouldn't do now, or I would in a different way, I think. You know, I was a little bit less ingrained in the culture wars than I am now, and I was a little bit more willing to vilify her, even though I tried to make her human, and she took exception. The point was that her father was part of the dictatorship that disappeared people's babies, dropped them into the ocean, or sold them to rich families, those kinds of things. And I said to her, you know, how is it right that you're the face of the pro-life side, and at the same time you've got this family history and you support your father in what he was involved in? So again, I'd love to have that conversation with her now and actually listen to some of the things she had to say a little bit more openly. But I was young. Anyway, long story short, no TV channel would take it. We got it into festivals, and that was about it, really.
It's an increasingly rare quality in today's world, being able to separate the person from the beliefs that they hold. If you are a Trump supporter, then that is your identity and you must be loathed for that reason. Or if you are pro-life, then that is, you know, you as a person. It feels like we're not particularly good anymore at being able to disagree with someone, but still appreciate their fundamental humanity.
Yeah, I think so. I'm thinking now, if I go back to those Theroux documentaries, he often did the right. It was looking at the right wing. And I would like to make an equivalent looking at the woke left. The same sort of thing, because a lot of the stuff we see about the woke left is people going to these rallies and making a fool of them and having that kind of thing. I would like to sort of get ready with one of these guys who's going to put all the Palestinian wear around him or her, you know, be in the room with them while they're making the flags and just sort of poke little questions and see if I can find some humanity in them. One of the issues, though, with it is, I think Louis has even said this, that one of the reasons he always did the right wing is because the right wing's a lot more fun and weird and extravagant. And I don't usually like when people point out differences between the far left and far right, because I really do think they're the same thing in so many respects. But I think if there was one key differential, it might be humor, because the far left is utterly humorless. Whereas I think the far right, even when they're going about doing horrible killings and whatever they might be doing, seem to have humor. And you can even see that. You look at the far left guys in Venezuela, in Cuba, wherever it was, these were just the Soviet Union, utterly humorless. And you look at Trump, I know some people might disagree if he's on the right, because he could have been either way. He just wanted to win, I think. But this is a guy who I've seen mixed with Seinfeld music and doing a real genuine traditional stand-up routine, a Seinfeld stand-up routine. So that's the problem with the left, I'd say. You've seen that. The straws.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Yeah.
I agree. I think there is a distinction around humor, and there's probably a distinction around an appetite for debate and discussion. I think in general, the elements of the right and even the far right are more comfortable debating their views. Whereas I think if you look at, say, the trans issue as an example, the far left proponents of trans ideology, it's part of the playbook not to engage in debate and discussion. Let's just use that as a segue. I've got a list of heretical statements in front of me. Don't necessarily agree with all of them, but I think they are all worthy of examination. I'm going to throw them to you and we'll use those as starters for discussion. Let's start with arguably the most taboo or heretical of areas, which is pedophilia, which you have looked at in your documentaries. Heretical statement one, pedophilia should be treated as a psychological disorder, not as a crime.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely not as a crime. I saw Joe Rogan talking about this the other day, and I think it was amazing to see that he hadn't fully grasped the concept of what pedophilia is. And he was saying, I don't understand how anybody could have a conversation about it because these are people who have done these abhorrent things. And as soon as he says that, you go, hang on, you want to sort of shout into the Rogan podcast and go, no, hang on, this is the condition. This is not having done anything. And I think that is something that the public needs to be aware of. It is thought that the vast majority of pedophiles, if that's what we call them, because no one can decide on what the name is of somebody who doesn't offend, so non-offending pedophiles, these are people who have spent their lives with what might be a mental illness, a psychological condition, as that statement says, who knows what? And they don't know. There is no real consensus on what forms, as there isn't on what makes people gay or straight or whatever it is, or if it's a sexuality, if it's just a mental illness, we don't know. The thing we do know is that a lot of children are abused. And that is paramount because that ruins a life. It ruins the life of these children. You're basically almost killing someone. I don't mean to suggest that anyone who's been abused doesn't still go on to live a life, but it's not the same life that they would have had they not been abused in that moment. It's a horrific thing to do to somebody. And then we've got a decision to make, almost in an effective altruism kind of way. We can either go, I feel that this is too emotional of a subject to engage in it, and I'm just going to shout things to look good, as Elon Musk might say, look good instead of doing good. It's the right-wing equivalent, maybe, where people would just go, just kill them all. And then they think, okay, job done. Well, that doesn't make any difference to all the children who are getting abused by these people. Just kill them all or just lock them up. Well, we can't find them all. They're hiding. And, you know, every time you do lock one up, another one is made or born or whatever it is. So I think we have to look at this in a really, again, effective altruism or very scientific way and go, what is the best possible way to reduce the number of children being abused? Because that's all that matters. That is it. And it is thought, according to this clinic in Germany that I visited called Don't Offend or Kein Täter werden, don't become an offender. The best way is to get these people in for therapy. Now, if one of these people, a non-offending pedophile, now, by the way, anyone listening, you don't have to like these guys. You can hate them. You can, whatever it is, I don't care. I'm not interested in that. And I just say that rather defensively because whenever I talk about it, people will just go, oh, so you think child abuse is fine? I'm like, no, I couldn't be saying the opposite more loudly or clearly. But they think you get these people in, disabuse them of their cognitive biases because we know that if you don't let them, so in Australia, if you go to a doctor, it's 1 in 100 men who have this condition. If they go to the, or mental illness, if they go to
a doctor. 1 in 100?
Yeah, yeah.
That would surprise a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. It's a lot. I mean, in men, women, it's thought to be significantly lower, but they do exist. And I've met one in the book, actually, in the Psychology of Secrets. So that was one whole chapter I dedicated to her because I was just fascinated by this. But 1 in 100 men, that's larger than the army in most countries, 1 in 100. So it's a lot of people. And that's very dangerous for children. You go to a doctor in Australia and say that they're struggling with these kind of afflictions or whatever it might be. The doctor has to report them to authorities and who knows what happens next. The doctor will be put in prison if they don't report them. Same in America. In the UK, they're not put in prison, the doctors, but they are struck off. They lose their jobs for not reporting. In Germany, they don't have this mandatory reporting. So one of these guys can come in and actually get help. If you don't let people go and get help, they just retreat to the dark corners of the internet where they all talk to one another and they start telling one another, hey, it happened to me when I was a kid and I'm fine. It's like, well, obviously you're not. You're on the dark web right now talking to pedophiles, you know? But they will tell each other that they are. This is human nature. And they will say, oh, all those people who rejected us, screw them. We can just abuse as much as we want. And that's what's going to happen. And the abuse rate is just going to go up. If they can go in, talk to doctors who say, hey, we understand. Here are some other people with your issue. We're going to work with you to make sure you never offend. That's a very difficult thing for most people to get on board with, because we don't like the idea that a doctor is being nice or seeming to be nice to the pedophile who's never offended. However, all that matters here is that they stop abusing children, and that's all I care about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's the age-old question of harm minimization versus retribution. I remember I did a debate at university, and the topic, I don't think you'd see this at a university campus today. It shows how the times have changed. But the topic was that we should legalize cartoon representations of pedophilia. And the debate there is basically, well, do you provide an outlet to that 1 in 100? And will that ultimately mean that less real kids will be abused if they have that outlet? Or alternatively, do you think that that will spark more people to get an interest in genuine pedophilic behavior?
Replacement versus stepping stone.
Mm. Tell me about that conversation that you had with that school captain.
Oh, yeah. Well, him. So he goes by Silas. That was his name. It's not his real name, obviously. And I don't even know where he's from. It's just I managed to get in touch with all these people through other people and through doctors and things like that. He is a prime example of the problem here, because he's young and happy and excited, which you don't expect to get. And a lot of these guys are sort of proud of themselves, and they think that they can stop themselves from actually carrying out any abuse. But the more I spoke to him, he started telling me that he was very much involved with all sorts of school, after-school activities. He was always there looking after the younger kids. Always, always, always. And there does seem to be, and I'm just speaking anecdotally, not really as a doctor. You know, I can't speak as a doctor, even if I wanted to. But he was... these guys always seem to have something more than just a sexual attraction. It's all encompassing. It's an obsession. And it's almost like this, just from what I've seen, a sort of a parental or a paternal love has gone wrong. Something's gotten weird here, and they're starting to get a kick out of it. I don't know what exactly is happening in their minds. So they also do really want to protect those children. They want to look after them. At the same time, they want to do, more than anything, the very thing that will ruin them beyond imagination. They want to do the worst possible thing to them. So this guy was a perfect example of that, because he couldn't see it. And he even said to me at one point, Andrew, you don't understand. Like, you know, I have to be around them. If I'm made, because I said, why don't you just, you know, not be in the after-school activities, why don't you just walk home and not tempt yourself, not be an alcoholic behind the bar? And he said, if I'm near them, I know I won't offend. You know, it was a cognitive bias. He's trying to tell himself that's what makes him feel comfortable. And I was trying to say, is that a threat? Are you saying if you were made to not be with them that you would have to offend? And he was like, no. This guy needs to go into the therapy. He needs to understand, hey, mate, you need to not be around these children. This is the worst thing for you and for them. But yeah, that's him. It's not much I can do, unfortunately, about him.
How do you reflect on the suggestion that by treating this as a psychological disorder, you implicitly say to these people that this is a condition, you don't have control over it, and therefore, in some way, you are enabling the behavior by saying that you don't really have free will over it?
I would say you're saying to them, hopefully it's done well and in a way that explains to them, look, the condition and the attraction is the psychological condition. Acting on it is the worst thing you can do. It's illegal. It's illicit. One of the problems that we have, I do actually agree with some of the more emotional people about this when they say they don't get locked up for a long enough time. Especially the older I get, I'm feeling that more and more. If I had kids now and some disgusting adult started trying to do things like that to them, and they go to prison for like a couple of years, and there are people in there for like accounting problems and things like that that are in for longer. So that is a huge problem. That's something that needs to, I mean, you, at the end of the day, this is a democracy, and maybe we do get emotional and you need level-headed people who say, okay, we're not going to lock everyone up for life, right? But there has to be something between life and 2 years. It's got to be longer. Not that it would act as a deterrent necessarily, and maybe that is then just retribution. Because those guys are going to get out and want the same thing. They get chemical castration a lot of the time, but that's not entirely effective, unfortunately.
I actually saw a tweet the other day, a case in one of the southern states of the US, Alabama, or one of those types of ones, where a pedophile wasn't just chemically castrated, they were castrated.
Physically.
Yeah, which I didn't know was a thing. They don't mess around in the South.
Yeah, yeah, that was done, I think, in Czech Republic as well. They used to do it there. There's a couple of countries where they would do that. And look, you know what? I don't want to, I'm just thinking out loud now because I hadn't really thought too much into this, but you know what people are saying, kill them, lock them up forever. Well, maybe that's the option. If I really am feeling more aggressive about this, but if you do something to a child and you know you're not supposed to, obviously, maybe that's it. You get your knobber cut off.
Well, let's leave pedophiles for now. I think if we've still got any listeners left, go to a perhaps slightly less heretical statement, but certainly one that is more prevalent in society. Heretical statement two, modern feminism has done more harm than good to women. We've had this conversation with several people on this podcast around this issue. People like Constantin Kissin and John Anderson have views on this topic.
Yeah, they're much smarter than me, first, and certainly more erudite. I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Erudite.
Where would the accent be if it was Spanish? It would be on the first letter, erudite. It's unusual for an English word that typically it would be erudite if you think about the emphasis would be in most words. I'm a linguist, not a feminist or whatever it might be. It's a really hard one because you know what it seems to me whenever we have this, whenever I've been involved in those conversations, it really feels like we're talking about semantics so often. What is feminism to you? And if feminism to you is equality for women and a hopeful, a pursuit of equality for women, then that sounds wonderful. And I've seen all sorts of stats recently suggesting that although support for feminism has gone dramatically down in recent years, support for the idea of equality of the sexes has stayed the same or gone up. So if you do see feminism simply as not a movement, but your own concept of, hey, to me, feminism is equality for women, then that's a great thing. Most people believe in it. Most people want that today. And it's also something that's unachievable. And I think that's one of the issues. I'm sure we'll talk about this. And this is at the center of a lot of what me and you talk about regularly, is this pursuit of perfection or equity is not only unachievable, but dangerous because it becomes authoritarian. And it's really nice as an idea and a concept. But of course, women can't be equal to men because women spend 9 months gestating. That is insane. It's an incredible thing that they do. They also have huge biological differences to men, different pursuits, different ideas, different ambitions. To try and understand which ambitions have been socially carved up and which are biological, it's an impossible concept. You can't ever even get close to that. So we don't know.
I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in 4 of their best selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup, 2 carry on sizes, 2 checked sizes, 4 colours, black, blue, pink, grey. Made from a high strength nylon, the bag is tear resistant as well as weather resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded, both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favorite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. awaytravel.com/heretics.
But also when that conversation arises, you cherry pick which biological differences are acceptable to talk about and which aren't. So there are articles you'll read like female leaders did better during COVID, and then they'll talk about feminine traits like empathy to be able to back that up. But if you talk about, say, the gender pay gap and you say, well, one reason why there may be a gender pay gap is that men are on average more assertive and therefore that helps in a salary conversation, that's a no-no because women can do everything that men can do. There is a degree of inconsistency in the way that we talk about this.
Yeah, that's spot on. And I'm always paying attention to something called the Diamond Diversity Survey or whatever it is, because it's all the DEI stuff in the UK. It's TV channels and who's on screen, who's off screen. And there's definitely a feeling that these people, the DEI diversity officers or whatever, they've got to keep their jobs. They have to find new things. And I understand that feeling. I'm a YouTuber, you're a podcaster. We've got to keep finding new things. And it's very stressful. What they're doing, I think, is bad, though, because it's creating friction in a society that doesn't need it and doesn't want that. But you look at these things, they're always trying to find something. So for years, I mean, 20 years ago, it was the idea that, you know, people on screen had to be exactly the right color and sex and this and that. And then they achieved that. They achieved that like 15 to 20 years ago. Like, that's how long ago that was achieved. And now they've gone way past it. Way past it. Minorities are significantly overrepresented. So what are they going to do, these DEI reporters? And you know, they look for what can we change next. So every single survey, they bring it out and it starts with can do better, of course, right? Otherwise you don't have a job. And you go to, like, it's now people off screen, but that started to become equal too. So now it's the people at the top off screen, and that started to become equal too. So now they're looking at places where there aren't enough women. Well, directors, right? There aren't many female directors on TV. However, the people above them with a higher job, a bigger status job, are the showrunners. Showrunners run the entire show and they hire the directors. So 70% of directors in the UK are male, but I think 80 or 90% of showrunners are female, the people who are employing the directors. But that's not where we have to do better, ladies and gentlemen. It's got to be all in the directors have to be more female. The other one is, like, stuff like lighting and cameras is mostly male. But, you know, makeup and those kinds of things are mostly female. Well, if we're going to get everything exactly right, we'll end up with the Bolsheviks or the Stasi. It's just no good. So, you know, somebody I spoke to recently, Ella Whelan, she was saying she prefers the term women's lib, instead of feminism. Feminism obviously has those connotations of these people just sort of shouting at men, trying to demean men. And so we've moved on to another word. Ultimately, I think the idea is to get as close as possible to equality without implementing authoritarian measures.
Yeah, and some people may not even be aware, if you're not involved in the culture war stuff every day, of the difference between equality and equity as terms. And you may use them interchangeably, but they're very different. The simplest way of looking at it is equality is quality of opportunity, and equity is quality of outcome or the same outcomes. And they're very, very different things. It's interesting. I was speaking to Gad Saad on this podcast not so long ago, and he was talking about the studies that have been done on happiness and how that's changed over time between the sexes. Generally, what you can see in the studies of happiness since about the 50s, men's happiness has actually stayed about the same from the 50s through to today. Women's happiness has fallen off a cliff. Women are, you look at survey data, considerably less happy than they were, say, in the 50s and the 60s. And it's an interesting paradox, because that's come as women's rights have become far more equal, and at least, you know, legally are equal to men in Western countries today. Mm. What do you put it down to?
Well, then you've got, you know, this was something I remember when I interviewed Julia Hart, who's an ex-Hasidic Jewish woman who did this. She did a Netflix series called My Unorthodox Life, and she's become like the Kardashian of people who have left cults, and they're all Kardashian-y because it's the opposite. It's that individualistic American dream life as opposed to the Hasidic Jewish life. And so I put it to her that, you know, a lot of the Hasidic Jewish women, because, I mean, it's even worse for women there than for men, particularly much worse, actually, you know, say that they are happier. So she said, look, a lot of them are, and they can be. But what is more important is the opportunity to choose, to be able to have the right to choose. So it's a really, really complex thing where a lot of people would prefer to be less happy and have more freedom. I know that sounds contradictory or like a paradox. So I guess in terms of putting what you said, what do we put that down to? Is it that having those kinds of liberties brings new kinds of problems? Or is it the case of what I think we're seeing with social contagion today, the more that you are told that you are oppressed, the more you start to feel like you are a victim, and that's no good for anyone. I know in my own life, whenever something bad happened to me, or, you know, small things, but people started saying, are you all right? That what that person did, that wasn't right. That's definitely not made me feel better. You know, that made me feel, God, maybe they did do a thing to me. And I think there is a lot of evidence for that as well in general. You tell people that they should feel upset and they will do. So it might be a mix of those two things. Too much liberty might be difficult to take on and reduce happiness in some respects. And also people telling you you're a victim, that's no good for anyone.
I wholeheartedly agree with both of those points. And I would add a third, which is just the gap between expectation and reality.
Oh, that's huge. Yeah, good one.
This for me is the happiness formula more generally. Is happiness really is about how close you can get that gap between what you expect out of life and what you actually have in life. And I think women have been sold a vision of being able to have absolutely everything, kids, family, the corporate job at the same time. And a lot of the time that is incredibly difficult to achieve. And when you've been sold that vision and you're not reaching that vision, that I think is another factor to throw into the mix.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I can hear people getting annoyed listening though, because they're just saying, oh, two men, they don't know shit. And people always say, hey, there's things. I think it's a bit idealistic. I hear from some women's libbers, as they are like to be called now. It's a little bit like the color thing with black people. It used to be able to say colored, then it was black, and then it's gone back to of color. And women's libbers was the old thing. And then we went to feminism, and now we've gone back to women's lib. That's now the popular thing to say. And they'll be saying, look, there's more that governments can do. There are creches for children. There are maternity packages, policies. There are all sorts of things that we can do to lighten the burden on women. And I think that's absolutely right. But ultimately, you know, we're always going to come up against certain difficulties that are biological and about different needs for men and women. I mean, women have periods that last 5 days or whatever. I mean, that how much might that have impacted on my life if I had to be in like constant pain for 5 days every month, cramps, blood everywhere, embarrassment, social embarrassment, anxiety. So we can do all we can to try and, you know, lessen that impact. But ultimately, that's going to have an impact. And it's shit. I don't know what more to say except that it's just shitty. So, yeah.
Heretical statement three is a question. I've actually had this on my list of interesting questions for some time, and I thought this would be a good podcast to throw it out. Apologies in advance at the risk of cancellation. If we were to find out tomorrow, conclusively and unambiguously, that one ethnicity was genetically dumber than other ethnicities, should it still be communicated to the public?
Oh, yeah, I think it has to be. I think it has to be because you just need transparency. Who are these elite keepers of information? What that would do to the world is I mean, that's the worst thing ever. I interviewed a guy called Marvin Chun, Dr. Marvin Chun, who looks into mind reading, and they're amazing what they can do. And we're at a point now with
when you
fMRI,
say mind reading, what do you mean?
Well, fMRI scans into people's brains. You can put people in a scanner and you can know what they are thinking, what they're dreaming. There's this great thing he does on YouTube. There's people at a conference and he's talking on stage, and you can it was done not necessarily by pictures, it was words popping up on the screen. So there was like a list of like 10 words, and the words were like house, garden, whatever. And then it got to man, and then woman, and then woman got bigger and bigger. It was like this big word that was happening, and the audience were laughing. And gradually you're made to understand that what's happening is you're inside somebody's dream. They had been reporting on someone's dream, and they could see that a woman was getting involved in his dream, and it obviously turned a bit sexual. So, which is, you know, cool, good for that person. They got lucky in their dreams. But amazing what we're able to do. I mean, at the moment, the ability, I mean, you can, the computers now can show what someone is looking at. They can actually show like a rough picture of Steve Martin if you're watching a Steve Martin film or something. It's remarkable. But at the moment, what we have, the fMRI can only sort of check into the nearest set of 1,000 neurons. But as we get better technology, they'll be able to locate individual neurons. And with AI, they'll be able to have a much better, basically a dictionary of all the neurons in your brain and what each one firing off really means you're looking at or thinking about. So mind reading will be a thing. And I'm sure it won't just be an fMRI scanner. People will be able to do it just with their phones. You'll be able to hack into people's minds and things. It's a really scary, scary thought. And that's the future. It might take hundreds of years. It might take 10 years. But what he said, there was something he said, what's great about that, and I didn't think this was great at all, but he said, what's great about that is we'll be able to scan people's brains to see who has a good brain. Because then if people who didn't get good education or whatever it might be, they can apply for a job and the job people can see, hey, this guy's got a great brain. He didn't get good exam results, but he's got such a great brain, we should hire him anyway. And I just thought, well, firstly, that's just going to create, I mean, there's something about the randomness of life that keeps things socially mobile. Once we've got a point where it's just, these are the good brains, these are the bad brains, as would happen in your hypothetical with the races, that is just, that's the end of society. I don't know what we do. There's something about the plucky underdog. I think we like the idea that person A could be smarter, maybe did go to a better school, has a better brain in every, but person B has something plucky about them that can't be empirically measured in a brain and still gets the job. So that it's still open for all of us. So the future is scary. And I'm sure that might happen. I think I have read stuff about, I mean, I'm Jewish and I'm sure I've read that Jews, I might be, maybe it's just something that Jews tell ourselves, that Jews have more intelligence. They've certainly won more Nobel Prizes. I mean, it makes sense when we look at evolution, not that Jews are smarter, but that one race might be. I mean, we have all different kinds of physical, mental advantages and disadvantages. That might happen. And I think it's the end of society as we know it. What do you think?
I think that the search for truth has to be of paramount importance, even if it leads to uncomfortable outcomes. I think that has to be the primary purpose of all of us. And I put this in the context of, say, a little clip I heard from Constantin Gissen recently around the impact that the new atheists have had on basically society today. And he drew a line from the new atheists to some of the woke stuff. The decline in organized religion has created a vacuum, and that vacuum has been filled by even more troubling ideologies like woke ideologies. And what I was thinking as I was watching that was, I think there's probably a case to be made that the rise of atheism has also seen a corresponding rise in some of this more troubling culture wars stuff. But I don't think that is a reason not to say have conversations around atheism and not to try and come to answers on questions around religion, because the search for truth needs to be paramount. And I think that is a principle which is increasingly under attack in society today.
There's that Bertrand Russell quote, when you are studying any matter or considering any philosophy, ask yourself only what are the facts and what is the truth that the facts bear out. Never let yourself be diverted either by what you wish to believe or by what you think would have beneficial social effects if it were believed, but look only and solely at what are the facts. And that's one of my favorite
snippets. You've done well to get that one out word for word.
Yeah, well, I've sneaked it out. The thing is, I've got a teleprompter in front of me, so I can see you in it, and I've got the notes in it. I'd love to have pretended I just had that in my head, but I've got it ready on notes though, because it's one of my favourite quotes, and it speaks to the times we're in now. You want to say to all the sort of trans activists and all these things, like, yes, lovely idea. It would be great if it were true. You could just, you know, these are all fantastic. We're on your side with this. However, we know that it's a slippery slope. Things start to unravel very fast once you give up the idea of truth. I was with Constantin recently at that New York Dissident Dialogues organized by Winston Marshall. And there was this brilliant climax where Richard Dawkins and Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who, for those who don't know, she had the fatwa at the same time as Salman Rushdie, had to go into hiding. She was an ex-Muslim and she's recently become a Christian. And it was just phenomenal because it was a big mix in the audience of people who were sort of on both sides. Some were religious like her, some were on Dawkins' side with the atheism. And she made a lot of those points as well. And Dawkins made the same point that you made of just like, well so what? So what if woke has come from this? Well, then they should teach rational thinking at school. That's what they should teach. That's the solution. I don't care. It's about truth and there's no truth here. And so, I sort of gave it a big round of applause and all that. And It was good fun.
I think the challenge with Dawkins for me is he's almost too rational for his own good. Everything he says, it's very difficult rationally to have a problem with it, but he misses some of the softer messages and implications around what he says because he is the most rational mind you'll come across. Yeah, it's interesting. You open the door on the trans thing. So let's go to heretical statement number 4. I actually think, because of, this is a less heretical statement than it was 3 or 4 years ago, because of the work of a lot of very brave people in shifting the Overton window. But still, if you were to say this in Fortune 100 company in the US today, I think you'd still probably be in a bit of trouble. Men can't be women.
It's hard to know, like, to what extent the Overton window has shifted and to what extent people like you and me and the listeners of this podcast have sort of gotten in our own little bubbles. And I can't understand, and I know you know this as well because of how I've heard you speaking, we can't understate quite how little most people in the public even follow any of this. How if I use the word woke, they won't even know what that is. A friend of mine who is a journalist and is involved very much in this thing, I mentioned DEI the other day, and she said, "What's DEI?" She didn't even know, and she's in the space. So people who are not. So I mean, to what extent are we just playing Dungeons and Dragons and sort of, or Pokemon, and collecting our little, you know? And most people don't even care. It's not on their radar.
It gives me the shits, actually. Sometimes when I'm quite proud of myself for finding a particular guest who's big in this world, I'll then casually tell a few friends and they'll go, "Oh, that's great. Who's that?" Bit of a downer. But you're right. I think we definitely do deceive ourselves some of the time.
I've been going now 4 years, and I'd say the most famous people I've had on are Richard Dawkins, right? Most people don't know who he is. They just don't. Most people do not know who Richard Dawkins is. That might sound shocking to most people listening, apart from the ones who are going, "But I don't know who he is." But they don't have to. I mean, there are plenty of people I don't know who they are. And Robbie Williams. And Robbie Williams, no one in America seems to know who he is, right? And that's crazy. No, nobody in the whole of America knows who Robbie Williams is. And young people often don't either. And it's just been gutting, really, that everything I've worked towards, nobody knows who anyone I've talked to is. The best bet is probably Winston Marshall, because they won't know the name Winston Marshall, but they'll know Mumford & Sons and that he was in it. They won't know the whole story. They won't know that he left, anything like that. So I don't know. All I know is my book is about psychology, secrecy. It's true crime and psychology. And there's not much culture wars, but there is a lot about suppression of thought and authoritarianism and stuff like that. But I have said on YouTube and often publicly that obviously trans women are not women. And every book festival, every book shop that was going to have me as a guest to promote my book, and those things are still pretty important to promote your book. You know, book sales are low. I read the other day, the average book doesn't even sell 12 copies. The average book published these days. It's absurd how low it is. And we're used to big numbers because YouTube, you need hundreds of thousands podcast just to make any money, make things work. Books, you just got to sell you sell a couple of thousand, you're doing well. And being able to go to festivals and bookshops and things like that, that makes a huge difference. And I've been disinvited, not from like 90% of them, from every single one of them, every single one, without conversation, without asking me what my beliefs really are, all of them. And I suppose as much as we're in a bubble, maybe ourselves, people in bookshops and publishing, it's a sad one because they think they're doing good and they must think awful things of us. As I did when I was a kid and I heard about, you know, some horrible sounding politician and didn't really know what their arguments could be. And it's a strange one because if they would just openly debate, they'd see that we don't think that we're bad people. We just care about truth. And you know, like you, I'm sure that I don't know. The more I got into this, when I started, I was sort of tepidly saying, "But they're not really women, are they?" And the more you get pushback for that, the more people get angry, the more they kick you out, the more you go, "You know what? Fuck this. It's a bloke in a dress." And ultimately, although that's not maybe the nicest thing to say to somebody who might have a psychological condition or an illness or whatever it is, I think that's actually safer than telling them, "Yeah, mate, you're a woman. Fill your boots," you know?
Yeah. On principle, I was supportive of, say, using preferred pronouns for a period of time.
Me too.
I spoke to Brendan O'Neill on this show, and he changed my mind on this because he said, basically, you think you're being polite, but what you're really doing is enabling an ideology which has so many downstream negative consequences. And when I say this, I don't say, you know, someone can't be trans. I couldn't care less what a consenting adult does to their own body. But by normalizing the worst elements of this ideology through the use of preferred pronouns, you are normalizing the conversion of children, transition of children, I should say. You are normalizing the women in men's jails. You're normalizing the women in men's sports. I think you're right that tiptoeing around it by thinking you are being polite actually can have very dangerous consequences. And I think that's why you do need to have the guts to actually say the truth, wherever the truth may lead.
It's all effective altruism. There's a great book, but nobody buys it.
For people who don't know the term, explain what effective altruism is.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, there's a great book. I only came across it recently, really. But don't get that book because you should get my book because, you know, you've only got a certain amount of money to, you know, not everyone can get loads of books. But Jenny Kleeman, who I'm a big fan of, and she's been talked of as a cross between Margaret Atwood and Louis Theroux. She writes these books about sort of robots in the future and vegan meats and those kinds of things. But she just had a book out about the price of everyone's lives and things like that. So effective altruism, she explained to me the other day, it's what sort of the big philanthropists like Elon Musk or Bill Gates, they're involved in. Whatever your thoughts are of them, the philosophy
Sam Bankman-Fried with the bloke has just gone to jail. It was also his kind of big guiding philosophy as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, but he was stealing money from people, wasn't he? So, which is no good. I suppose that's effective altruism for him. He's being altruistic to himself very effectively until he ends up in prison. So it wasn't actually a very good idea. It wasn't very effective. But the idea is, as Jenny explained to me, there are people who say, a building's on fire. Do you save an 8-year-old child or do you save a Picasso? Well, the Picasso is worth enough money that it could help to save thousands of children in various situations. So effective altruism is saying, hey, turn off your emotions for a moment. Let's do what's best for the most people. It's very utilitarian. I think to actually do that, to actually save a Picasso rather than a child, you'd have to be a psychopath. And I'm sure many people
through my mind.
Yeah. Well, to go full in, like if you go full in on anything, you know, you've got to be a bit off. To go full in on effective altruism, you probably do have to be a psychopath.
But well, this explains why it is very appealing to ultra intelligent, but potentially like kind of almost autistic, high achieving tech billionaires.
That's right. I think exactly spot on. But it's also something that is seen as a counter to some of the woke culture, which is seen as just very visceral, emotional, not really well thought out. And I don't get this very often, but every now and then an old friend of mine will reach out and say, hey, I've seen you on Piers Morgan, or, you know, well done. They'll often be polite, well done on this, well done on that. However, and I always know it's coming, and it tends to be, it's always, so far, it's always been, oh no, there was one guy and several women who've got in touch, and they said, almost a dig in a very sly way. It's almost pissed me off. I wish they'd just actually come out with it, but just very well done. I'll just say that, you know, shame about having a go at the vulnerable people. You know, there are vulnerable people here at stake, blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking at that point, right, am I going to Facebook message this old acquaintance of mine from 10 years ago explaining the values of effective altruism in this respect, which is, yes, you think you're helping, but I think I'm helping. And I don't want to say you're wrong or I'm, obviously I think you are wrong, but we both have our points of view. But you're implying that I'm somehow morally less concerned about these people. And that is offensive. I resent that because I think what I'm doing is much better for them. I did, you know, my first documentary at the BBC, well, the only documentary now really, was Exorcism. The parallels between exorcism and trans and gender are just startling. It's insane. You've got, particularly for the, I'm not talking about the AGP, people who've got an attraction to, right. just for people, if they're not fully into this whole thing, it seems that other than people who've got several nervous conditions and things, there seems to be a lot of older men who have or might have AGP, which is autogynephilia, an attraction to the idea of being perceived as the other sex. And we had that recently. We had this great question asked to Grayson Perry, who's an artist in the UK who dresses as a woman and has worn like a strap-on dildo to children's charities and things like that. And he was asked, do you think that people get upset with what you're doing because they see what you're doing as sexual and they haven't consented to being part of your sexual act? And he said, yeah, it is that. So a lot of people will admit that it is a sexual thing. And I feel the same thing. I don't want to be part of someone's, you know, whatever they do in their own home, if they're thinking about, but I don't want to have to be there looking at their dildo. He's an extreme case, of course. And then 17-year-old girls, 16-year-old girls who want to convert to being boys. It tends to be that way around when they're younger. This is an age where these are adolescents. These are people who have no control over their lives. They feel like they're being looked at all the time. Their bodies, they're ashamed of their bodies. They often get things like anorexia, bulimia. It's just that age. And if you're in Argentina, where I was, and that's how you're feeling at that time, and I'm talking about not the modern part of Argentina, but if you're in a sort of an old-fashioned part, somebody will say to you or to your parents, hey, have you considered exorcism here? This might be a case of demonic possession. And all very seriously, they will go down there. The exorcist will give them a, well, what do you think? What are your voices in your head like? And what's going on here and there? And they'll have the exorcism. And people in the West, including woke people, will laugh at that and go, God, how ridiculous, how old-fashioned, how pathetic, how silly. And the people here, exactly the same thing. They're out of control. They're having problems. And someone will say, do you think you might be the wrong body here? So instead of a demon in exorcism, you've got a gendered soul. I've got the boy soul inside me. This needs to be taken out. There's something wrong with my body. These are such common fears and anxieties for children, particularly girls. It is frightening that doctors, that psychologists haven't cottoned onto this, haven't applied this across the board and said, these are kids with issues that they will grow out of. And if we do something to them now, it's going to scar them for life. And that's what's happening. And that's what my friends who reach out to me and say, you know, you look what you're doing to vulnerable people. That's what I would charge them with.
Yeah, that's a fascinating analogy. And it just points to the fact that this is, you know, I think Helen Joyce came out and said this is entirely social contagion. She doesn't buy into any sort of medical explanation. I look at Hollywood actors and actresses and the percentage of those kids of Hollywood actors and actresses which are now coming out as non-binary or whatever. It's statistically impossible. It goes to show that this is, that the contagion element is what's there. I want to go to a new heretical statement. I've lost track of my numbering system. Islam is incompatible with Western liberal democracy.
God, these are great questions or statements.
And I can just kind of throw them out there without necessarily owning them. That's the beauty of this. This one I actually will own, but go on.
Islam, it's so, look, I'm an atheist and I don't want to put off anyone who's not, because I'm very open to people who are religious. But these are books full of things that, as far as I'm concerned, never happened. They have no historical basis. I find myself at Passover with my family being the downer, explaining that I don't think there's actually any evidence that the Jews were in Egypt enslaved for all that time, or that Moses lived to 800 years old, things like this. In fact, these are things, if you look at them, that we know didn't happen. Some of it's we don't know if it happened, and some of it's we know it didn't happen. So the only reason I sort of pause there is because I feel reluctant to say that one book of what I consider to be unfactual storytelling is necessarily more harmful than another. There's a lot of really pretty awful stuff in the Bible, stoning gays and all sorts of things like that. The Jewish versions, I don't even know it that well, but I know there's some pretty bad stuff because I grew up around it and remember being just abhorred by a lot of it. I think Dawkins again said this recently. He said the issue with Islam is not necessarily the text. It's just the fact that the people who practice it are 700 years in the past. And there seems to be a growing movement, you mentioned Constantine before, of people saying, listen, we need storytelling. Religion's gone and this mad woke stuff has come to replace it. Obviously, I mean, the Soviet Union were atheists and they were like the most religious people you can get, but they were religious to other stories. It's all about stories. And you can argue that, hey, if we need to have stories, if we absolutely must as human beings, then Christianity right now and Judaism and several other religions that seem to have been modernized over the years, far better equipped than Islam, just because of the way that its adherents practice it, which is so long in the past. I mean, it's back with the Christians and the Crusades and all of those kinds of things, that kind of behavior. I think I would, just because I don't want to give too much of a wishy-washy answer, I would say I'm one of my biggest concerns, and one of the biggest concerns of pretty much everyone I know now, is growing immigration from people who don't fit or don't want to fit and who want to come to a new place and because they don't like the place they're in, to make it shit again. Not to suggest that everywhere that people have been immigrating from is shit, but this happens as well on the other side. This happens with, I was speaking to people in the States recently who are saying, interesting, a lot of the woke people leaving San Francisco and moving to Austin, Texas, and all these, they're becoming democratic states. And it's just like, look, can you not put two and two together here? Like, you made San Francisco shit, right? By all accounts, you can't even, it's just awful that, and you're moving to the most conservative place because you like how they have it, and you're going to try and make it back how you had it before. Like the hypocrisy. And then the whole time you're just going to resent all the people who are actually from that place and make them feel like shit. Well, the same thing's happening, and it's happening with Islam. I do resent the charge that it's racist. You keep hearing that, particularly in the UK. I mean, why wouldn't people be anti-Hindu? Why wouldn't they be anti-Sikh, anti-Buddhist, anti-Sephardic Jews if they had a problem with people's skin color? It doesn't make sense, even for you just look at it for 1 second, it doesn't make sense. So there is an issue. There's an issue around the way that people are practicing Islam, and I don't think it's compatible with the West. And I'm scared because I keep seeing there are people who have taken positions of powers now. There was a guy the other day, I don't know if you saw, in the north of England who became a councillor. He's shouting Allahu Akbar on his acceptance speech, running around screaming. And you go in, the people in England associate that phrase with the 7/7 bombings of buses and trains here, of New York as well, 9/11. That's what we associate. How can you represent us as a people when the vast majority of us are frightened to death of the thing you say in your acceptance speech? So yeah, go on. What did you want to say?
I agree. I'm moving to the UK in a month or so, and the rise of this religious sectarian politics in the UK, I think is terrifying. And there is no doubt that politicians, and it's not just Islamic politicians, it's non-Islamic politicians, are galvanizing religious groups and getting them to vote as blocs. It's particularly dangerous in countries that don't have compulsory voting. I'm unsure on compulsory voting. Australia has compulsory voting. And I think it actually is a bulwark against that sort of rise of sectarian politics, because it's not as easy just to get a small,
interesting,
a powerful 20% minority. And that can swing an election when you have to get the middle ground. I saw that footage of that councillor in Leeds and I was terrified. And there's no doubt as well, if you look at Sadiq Khan in London, he wasn't as overt, obviously, but galvanising the growing Islamic population in London was a very important part of his re-election. And there's this very, very weird union of Islamic voters and liberal progressives. And the liberal progressives would disagree with a lot of the core tenets of Islamic ideology, I would have thought, particularly around, say, treatment of women. And yet it's that weird union that is actually driving the election of people like Sadiq Khan in progressive areas. And I'm very worried. I spoke to Matt Goodwin the other day. He talked about the stats that said that the number of people in the UK who are Islamic at the moment is, I think, around 5 or 6%. That's going to go up to closer to 18, 19, 20%, I think, by 2050. That is a monstrously big shift in the social demographics. And I'm very worried for the UK as to where that leads.
Well, especially when you consider, I mean, I look at things from a very Jewish perspective, being Jewish. My wife is as well. She's from Argentina. There's not many Jews in the world. Deceptively few. I'm sure some will say, oh, well, then why are so many in power or whatever? But I think that's something you should, whatever. That's a whole different discussion, actually. But the point is, the population of British Jews, we make up 0.5% of the country. It means that when you're looking at these, the sort of disinformation going around sort of Israel, Palestine, and things like that, around the whole country in the UK, there is not a city that doesn't have a significant population of Muslim people who will be hearing, even well-intentioned Muslims, as there are many, of course, will be hearing very different stories, different facts, different figures that are not actually anywhere close to the truth. And everybody in the UK who's not, again, not as into the culture wars and all this stuff as you and I, as you and I? Sorry, I obsess over things.
As you and I are.
I'll allow it. Yeah, thank you. They will be hearing all of these things. You know, I get into the car in a taxi. I got in a taxi in New York. The guy, you know, he wasn't even Muslim. He's telling me, yeah, I've heard that they're eating babies in Palestine. The Jews are eating the babies. They're hearing all these things. The Jews, although many might see them as in positions of power and Jerry Seinfeld and all of these kinds of things, in reality, there are very, very few of us, particularly outside of Northwest London in the UK. We have no influence over the common person. As that Muslim population rises, I think it's something like 70% of Muslims believe that Jews eat babies. Or there are loads of mad stats around the beliefs of Muslim people in the UK. That's really scary. And so it might seem over the top, but I do have these nightmares where what happened on October 7th happens in the UK, because why wouldn't it? Yep. Why wouldn't it? If it can happen over there, and they might say, oh, because the same stuff isn't happening with Israel, whatever. It could happen. We've had terrorist attacks. We've had coordinated ones. So why wouldn't they look? And what do? They put a fucking mezuzah on the door. I wish that we would, you know, it's sad. I'm not religious anyway, so I don't need to have a mezuzah on my door. For anyone who doesn't know, that's a little thing on the side of the door Jewish people tend to have. It's got a little script inside it, some sort of religious thing. My family members have those, and I've said to them, you know, if this uprising were to happen, maybe it's very unlikely, but in the next 10, 15, 20 years, one night where they go looking for those kinds of signs, I would take that down. You know, there's two mosques very close to where I live. It's a very Muslim area where I live, and it's really, really scary. So I don't know what happens next. And what I would say about those people who are not Muslim, who are welcoming them, who are standing in the background smiling while the guy's shouting Allah Akbar, that's that Christopher Hitchens quote, the barbarians never take a city until someone holds the gates open to them. And it's your own multicultural authorities who will do it for you. That was decades ago and so prescient. It's just, I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, 2008, I've shared that on Twitter a few times. It is scarily prescient. Your new book is wonderful. It is titled The Psychology of Secrets. Why were you interested in secrets as a concept to explore?
I think part of me wanted to write something that wasn't just culture wars, although I wanted something that would reach people, some sort of theme that will reach people who are not on my side and sort of just remind them of some of the ways that secrets have been used to oppress people over the years, the kinds of methodologies used by the Stasi and the Bolsheviks and Scientology and Hasidic Judaism and extreme Islam and all of these kinds of things. So partly that was on my mind. Secondly, I had long been doing that whole kind of Louis Theroux shtick, even when documentaries weren't made in the end. So what do you do when you've got stories about an exorcist, you've got stories about the crazy baby lady and the female 25-year-old pedophile that I met in a small village in Germany? Loads of stories like that. And you're going, what do they all have in common? Well, they were all keeping big secrets. I probably shouldn't expose the one of the exorcist. The 25-year-old female pedophile, it's obvious what hers was. And while I was thinking of that and trying to sort of meld that all together, I was getting more and more messages from viewers. I don't get so many now, but I was at that sort of micro-influencer stage of sort of 0 to 1,000 subscribers or whatever at the time. And they say that that's the most valuable stage per subscriber. Because if you're Kim Kardashian, you've got subscriber bases the size of continents now, like 500 million people or whatever. Well, per person, like most of them don't even care. They're not involved. But an influencer with just 1,000, everyone's like, I know this guy, he's replying to me. So you've got this very close bond. And people were messaging me and they would start their messages with things like, hey, my first memory is my grandpa putting his hand down my pants. And I'm like, okay, what? Like, why are you telling me this? And the book starts on a murder or a killing, at least by a woman I know who I worked with for a bit. I worked in the same industry as her, a sort of journalist-y kind of woman. I can't say who she is, but she encountered someone in an alleyway and she put her hands through this guy's eyes and it killed him. And she was telling me this. And I'm going, why is she telling me this? So again, it was like, what was it about how I was behaving, how I was acting? I wanted to find out what qualities in us make people reveal stuff to us. So I've sort of mixed a bunch of maybe true crime psychology stories with history, with the Stasi and all of that, with just this overarching thing of, you know, secrets. What are they? Why do we tell them? What happens to us when we keep them?
It's a wonderful read. It's ideal as a holiday read. It's got that John Ronson very story, getting to a very human story, but then telling a deeper truth through that story. I thought it was wonderful, Andrew. Congratulations.
Thank you.
As a now published author, Needless to say for everyone who is listening that you have, in my opinion, the second best Culture Wars podcast going around. So everyone sign up for Heretics. And looking forward to doing this again in person in London. Thank you for coming on Fire at Will.
Thanks for having me. I'm back at the end, although for me, only about 5 seconds have passed since I said I'll be back at the end. But you've just listened to an entire episode. You're going, what are you talking about when you said I'll be back at the end? I said it right at the intro and I said I'll be back at the end, but I've just stayed where I am. I'm still recording this. Please do, if you liked that, which I'm sure you did, listen to Fire at Will. Great podcast. Can't speak highly enough of Will Kingston. Top person. Get hold of my book, The Psychology of Secrets. Oh, but you know, I always forget to say, spread the podcast around. Give it to your friends. Tell people about it. I need more people listening. Want you all listening. And like I say, I'm talking from the past. I'm weeks before. I was gonna say I'll be a married man by now, but I don't want to jinx things. Because, yeah, by the time this comes out, that should be the case. But that's what's kicking off over the next few weeks. Anyway, as a wedding present, you can all share this podcast around, do all the kinds of reviews on Apple, those kinds of things. It helps a lot. And I'll see you next time.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say. Your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, class. Today we're going to talk about careers. What do you all want to be when you grow up? Nathan.
I want to be an influencer.
Yeah.
Influencer. Okay. How about Julie?
I want to help people do better in life.
Love yeah. it. Josh.
I want to earn a competitive salary and great benefits, like student loan repayment. What? You guys don't?
Guess what? There's one career that offers all of those things. Anyone? The answer is teaching.
Illinois needs teachers more than ever, especially in bilingual education, special education, and in rural and urban areas. As an educator, you're helping to build a brighter future for your students and your community every day.
And you get to go in the teacher's lounge.
Start your teaching journey today at becometeacher.com.